All right, our sermon text this morning is printed there in your bulletin, or you can turn your Bibles or on your devices to 2 Kings chapter 6. That's 2 Kings chapter 6, we'll be reading verses 1 through 23. Please read along with me. Now the sons of the prophets said to Elisha, "See, the place where we dwell under your charge is too small for us. Let us go to the Jordan, and each of us get there a log, and let us make a place for us to dwell there." And he answered, "Go." Then one of them said, "Be pleased to go with your servants." And he answered, "I will go." So he went with them. And when they came to the Jordan, they cut down trees. But as one was felling a log, his axe head fell into the water. And he cried out, "Alas, my master, it was borrowed." Then the man of God said, "Where did it fall?" When he showed him the place, he cut off a stick and threw it in there and made the iron float. And he said, "Take it up." So he reached out his hand and took it. Once, when the king of Syria was warring against Israel, he took counsel with his servant, saying, "At such and such a place shall be my camp. But the man of God sent word to the king of Israel, "Beware that you do not pass this place, for the Syrians are going down there." And the king of Israel sent to the place about which the man of God told him. Thus he used to warn him, so that he saved himself there more than once or twice. And the mind of the king of Syria was greatly troubled because of this thing. And he called his servants and said to them, "Will you not show me who of us is for the king of Israel?" And one of his servants said, "None, my lord, O king, but Elisha, the prophet who is in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words that you speak in your bedroom." And he said, "Go and see where he is, that I may send and seize him." It was told him, "Behold, he is in Dothan." So he sent there horses and chariots and a great army, and they came by night and surrounded the city. When the servant of the man of God arose early in the morning and went out, behold, an army with horses and chariots was all around the city. And the servant said, "Alas, my master, what shall we do?" And he said, "Do not be afraid, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." Then Elisha prayed and said, "O Lord, please open his eyes that he may see." So the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha. And when the Syrians came down against him, Elisha prayed to the Lord and said, "Please strike this people with blindness." So he struck them with blindness in accordance with the prayer of Elisha. And Elisha said to them, "This is not the way, and this is not the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom you seek." And he led them to Samaria. As soon as they entered Samaria, Elisha said, "O Lord, open the eyes of these men, that they may see." So the Lord opened their eyes, and they saw, and behold, they were in the midst of Samaria. As soon as the king of Israel saw them, he said to Elisha, "My father, shall I strike them down? Shall I strike them down?" He answered, "You shall not strike them down. Would you strike down those whom you have taken captive with your sword and with your bow? Set bread and water before them, that they may eat and drink and go to their master." So he prepared for them a great feast, and when they had eaten and drank, he sent them away, and they went to their master. And the Syrians did not come again on raids into the land of Israel.
First of all, say thank you to this church for being a Campus Aware church. Y'all love my family. Y'all love college students. Y'all support us. It means a lot, and it brings me great joy to see like RES students loving the church. That's our dream. So, what we're doing is we're dropping down into the middle of 2 Kings, which I realize can be confusing. This is in the middle of some accounts that happen with Elisha, and just Elisha is a prophet of God, which means prophets represent God. So when you interact with a prophet, you're interacting, it's like a confrontation with God himself. And Elisha is the prophet for northern kingdom of Israel, their capital Samaria. This is what's happening here. So here's the question I want you to consider this morning. Do you actually see correctly? Do you see yourself, the world, and God correctly? And the way that I want to illustrate that is through Harry Potter, all right, the famous wizard. So if you're unfamiliar with Harry Potter, he is probably the most famous wizard to ever exist, and he didn't always know that. He actually lived with his uncle and aunt, and he grew up underneath a staircase, unaware of everything. But as he starts discovering the world as it really is, it's probably typified by when he gets his invitation to go to Hogwarts, the School of Wizardry, and he gets a ticket that says, come to platform 9 3/4. So he's being driven there by Uncle Vernon. Uncle Vernon, okay, is going to embody everything that we call blindness, because he thinks the only thing that's real is what I can see and touch. And so when Vernon drops off Harry at King's Cross, a real train station, right, he looks at platform 10, he looks at platform 9, and he very smugly says, I guess they forgot to build your platform, right? And he drives off. And Harry, also confused, is looking around, doesn't know what to do, until the Weasley family bumps into him. And when he begins to get to know the Weasley family, they reveal something that otherwise he never would have seen. That platform 9 3/4 is right there through that pillar. As he goes through the pillar, it's pretty awesome. All of a sudden, this whole new world is unveiled. It's always been there. He just never saw it. He sees this magical train. He sees all these wizards and witches running around. But at that moment, what had always been there now became sight. And you get this really cool picture that Harry once was blind, but now he sees the world as it really is. But Vernon, who's convinced he can see, is actually blind. Does that make sense? Because the account of this Elisha with his servant, the king of Syria, presses into this truth that humanity, this is what the Bible teaches, that humanity in our natural condition does not see the world as it really is. We don't see ourselves. We don't see God as it really is. Sin has really distorted us. And we are dependent on God to reveal to us what He is like and what this world is like. It's what the Apostle Paul in Ephesians 1 says. It calls it the enlightening of the eyes of our heart. It's why Christians have always sang and asked for God to open their eyes. If you think about Amazing Grace, what do we celebrate? I once was blind, but now I see. That's what this is talking about. So I want to ask, you know, of this passage, what does blindness look like? And I would suggest that in this account you see that blindness, not seeing the world correctly, looks like three things. That blindness is characterized by seeing the world as if God is unaware or unconcerned with this world. Second of all, blindness is seeing the world as if God has abandoned us and he is absent. And third, blindness is characterized as seeing the world as if God is actually against us and not for us. All right? Those three things. So first, blindness is seeing the world as if God is unaware, as if he's unconcerned. This is verse 1 through 12. The first event, this is really strange. You've got all these prophets who've been following Elisha. Apparently that number's growing and they don't fit in the room that they meet anymore. So they ask to go build onto this room. And as they're cutting wood by the Jordan River, an axe head flies off into the river. And the guy exclaims, oh no, right, I borrowed this axe. In other words, I'm the one who's going to have to pay for this. And the prophet was probably poor, so iron's expensive, so he's very nervous, right? So what in the world? How in the world does this incident display our blindness? What's not being seen? I think blindness is characterized by, if your reaction to this passage is anything like mine. When I read this, I think, why in the world is that in the Bible? Like that, it's an axe head that goes into the river. Why is that something worthy of a miracle? Like it kind of honestly seems like a pointless parlor trick. But I think that characterizes the blindness. Because as we look at this miracle, we think, that's such a small thing. Why would God care about that? But see, that's the blindness. The second event involves the king of Syria, verse 8 through 13. And what's happening in Israel's history has been happening for a while, that Syria is pillaging Israel's villages. But somehow, as the Syrian king plans to attack an Israelite village, somehow Israel keeps becoming aware, and they either leave or they plan for the attack. And so the king is understandably frustrated. His plans keep being thwarted. And so how does this incident display what blindness looks like? Because look how the king of Syria reasons. If the enemies keep finding out about my plans, the only explanation must be, I have a traitor within my midst. Right? The king of Syria is functioning as if God isn't real or God doesn't know all, so the only way that someone is finding things out is I must have a traitor within my midst. Because he sees and assesses the world as if the only thing is real is what I can see and touch with my hands. And so both these incidents, I think, reveal what it means to be blind. And it reveals our own blindness. that naturally we don't see God as involved in our day-to-day life. We're like the king of Syria. We think he's either unaware, or we're like the prophets, and we think that God doesn't care about the small things in our life. And that can be on a big kind of scale. One of the probably common things from skeptical college students that I hear is they look at the world, and they're right, they see the evil. They see the death, they see genocide, and they assess, I guess God is either not real or doesn't care. Or it can look like, just in our everyday life, because this will happen where you or me or a college student will say something like, I mean, I just know this is so small, it probably doesn't matter, whatever, my chronic pain. Because when I'm compared to the kid in Africa, I think it doesn't matter. But that's the blindness. Because what gets revealed, and again, God has to reveal it, our eyes must be opened. Here's what gets revealed, that the king of Syria gets confronted with this fact, where the guy comes and says, I promise, none of us are traitors. There's this prophet Elisha who hears your conversations in the privacy of the bedroom. He knows what's going on. In other words, what gets revealed is there's nothing that's hidden from God. Nothing. He knows all. And then Elisha, the prophet of God, representing God, actually responds to the guy's cry about an axe head, walks up, throws a stick in, the iron floats to the top, and they grab it. And what gets revealed as their eyes are opened is that God is actually aware of all things. And he cares about even these small things that nobody else cares about. I've got a friend who recently told me a story he can remember from when he was like 5 or 6, and you know, he loved G.I. Joes, and he was talking to his dad, and you know, he just said, Dad, do you like G.I. Joes? And this is the greatest dad answer, right? The dad looked at him and said, well, son, do you like G.I. Joes? He said, I love G.I. Joes. He said, well, then I love G.I. Joes too. That's the great dad answer, because he said, son, if your heart cares about it, man, I do too. This is what God's like. If you care about it, if you're concerned about your chronic pain, if your loneliness is bothering you, it's bothering God as well. That's who he is. And so my question is, where are you this morning? Are you blind or do you see? Do you really believe and see that nothing is hidden from God? That all of life is lived before him? That the things that go on in your dorm room, the thing that goes on in the privacy of your bedroom or just driving to work, like, he sees those. He knows those. Because starting to see is that I become aware that all of my life is lived before him. But it's not just that he's aware. He actually cares. Yes, he deeply cares about the sex trafficking that's going on behind the scenes. And he will one day do something about it. But he also sees and cares about the stuff that you and I think we just brush off as no big deal. He cares about your sadness. He cares about the fact that you don't really like your job and you're just trying to grind it through. He cares that your food allergy makes life hard. Like, that's how detailed he is, because he's a good father. So first, blindness is beginning to see the world, is seeing the world as if God doesn't exist or doesn't care, but I'm starting to see when I start realizing he really does. Second of all, blindness is seeing the world as if God has actually abandoned us and we're all alone. Right, so when the king hears about Elisha, he decides, okay, I guess the way to defeat Israel, you know, to kind of make this happen is we've got to capture Elisha. I think this is actually supposed to be humorous, right? He finds out he's in a little town called Dothan, so he tries to come at night to surprise Elisha. Again, this is funny because Elisha already knows everything, apparently. And so they surround Elisha's camp, or where he's in a tent, it appears, with his servant. Dothan's down in a valley. So when Elisha's servant wakes up and walks outside, what does he see? But they are literally surrounded by the Syrian army. And the servant's reaction reveals blindness. Because he assesses the situation, he cries out, what shall we do? Why? Because the only thing that is real is what he can see with his physical eyes. And so he thinks we're isolated. We're alone, we're outnumbered. In other words, God isn't with us. When we needed him, he has not shown up. But then Elisha says, think how crazy this would sound if you were Elisha's servant. Elisha says, do not be afraid, for those who are with us are more than are with them. And you're looking around. Doesn't seem that way. And then he prays, Lord, open his eyes. And all of a sudden, the servant sees the world as it actually is. And surrounding them is not only the Syrian army, but surrounding them is even more chariots of fire, which is Bible shorthand for the armies of God. The spiritual forces of cherubim and seraphim and angels, which always indicate the presence of the Lord is actually there. And so he sees kind of through the veil of what the Bible teaches, that there really are two realms, heaven and earth, and they intersect, and they really are impacting each other. And so here's the point. When God opens the eyes of Elisha's servant, he realized, oh, we're not alone. God is actually surrounding us and protecting us, though I didn't know it. So when Elisha's servant's eyes are opened, it didn't create that reality. It was always there. It's just now he saw what was true and his fear and panic went away. Not because something new showed up. He just saw the world as it really was. His faith became sight. I saw something like this a little bit back last spring. My former female intern, her name was M.D. Stum. If you ever met her, she was awesome. But she, the important fact is she graduated from the University of Virginia. If you remember anything about last spring, University of Virginia makes the Final Four, eventually wins the national championship. So when she finds out that makes the Final Four, she is determined to figure out how she's going to go watch them in the Final Four. If you don't know this about RAF interns, they don't make a lot of money. They live for the poverty line. So money becomes a real issue, right? I've got to buy a plane ticket. How can I get there? And so she really becomes anxious. Like, this becomes the thing she's trying to figure out for 4 or 5 days. How can I get to the Final Four? And it's really consuming her. What she doesn't know, because RAF students are awesome, is that when RAF students found out, about 50 out of them started gathering money. They started contacting even her parents. And they went to work behind the scenes to make sure they got her tickets, they got her plane tickets to send her there. So I got to be the one on Tuesday morning staff meeting before that weekend to present to her that she was going. And I remember she walks in, she's tired. She'd actually been up late trying to find plane tickets that would fit in her budget. And she had basically given up. And she walks in tired, anxious, kind of downtrodden. I get to tell her, hey, you're going to the Final Four. And, it, you know, she starts crying, and I'm telling her why. Here's what she needs to realize, that the whole time she was anxious, this is actually what she told me, because I was thinking the whole thing was up to me. And if she had only known that behind the scenes there were forces, let's say 50 to 60 REF students at work surrounding her, making it happen, she would have been so less anxious, so less in panic. And I realize it's only a basketball game, right? But it still illustrates the truth. That her panic and anxiety wasn't hitched to what was real. It was hitched to her imagination because she didn't know what was really happening. She was blind to it. This incident in 2 Kings 6, what it shows for us is that we are like the servant. So often, circumstances or even our own feelings, what it seems is that we're alone. That God has abandoned us. That the only person that's looking out for me is me. That's what we think. That's what I think. And living by faith means that I begin to live according to what's true, no matter how I feel. One of my favorite pastors, Joe Novenson, who deeply struggles with depression and other things, he said every day he has this prayer written on his desk. He says, I have to read it. It says, by faith I'll live according to what's true, no matter how I feel, asking God to make what is true feel more real to me than what I feel. And man, if you know yourself, like, that is how we all live. And so that's my second question. Do you know, do you see the world as it really is, that God is actually with us? Because if you try to walk the path of obedience, here's what's going to happen. Obeying the Lord makes it seem like I'm going to lose. Because I feel like the only person that's going to look out for me is me. So commands about generosity, commands about telling the truth, commands about confronting a friend. All that stuff, it starts feeling like, I can't do this because it's going to put me behind. Or the only person that's going to look out for me is me. And it feels like it, but God's presence is with you. He's defending you. He's for you. And even when we think about our future, I get riddled with anxiety so much when I think about the future because I think the only person that's going to look out for me is me. And I imagine 3 months from now if it's only me. But God is with you. And that even comes with the big stuff. And I admit there's tension and I can't take it away, but when cancer or unemployment or bad things happening, it's still the truth that God is surrounding you and He's defending you and He's protecting you. So are you seeing? Are you seeing that God is, He sees all, He cares, and He's with you? And then thirdly, blindness is characterized by seeing the world as if God is actually not for you, He's against you. trying to destroy you. This is verse 18 through 23. What happens next, I think this is hilarious. Elisha prays that God would strike the Syrian king with blindness. The Syrian king either, and the whole army, they either don't see or their vision gets so distorted that the one that they came to kill, Elisha, they start following, right? Elisha says, I'll lead you to where you need to go. And so they follow him 14 miles out of Dothan into Samaria, which is the capital of Israel. And then Elisha prays that their eyes would be opened. And when their eyes are opened, they are no longer in Dothan surrounding Elisha. They are now in the capital of Israel, and they are surrounded by Israel's army. And at that moment, the Syrian army rightly assumes, we're dead. And the king of Israel rightly assumes, clearly God is giving us our enemies. Let's kill them, right? Twice he says, let's kill them. And Elisha says, no. Because what the Syrian army thought and what the Israelite king thought is actually blindness. Right? Elisha says, no, feed them, throw them a party, and then let them go. You realize how crazy that is? These are the people who try to kill the Israelites. But what God is revealing through Elisha to the blind Syrians and even the Israelite king is this, that God is not a God who wants to enslave and destroy you fundamentally. God is a God who wants to forgive you and liberate you and feed you and give you life. Because everybody, look, everyone else assumes when you capture your enemy, you kill them. That's what everybody does. But that's the blindness. God says, that's not what I'm like. I'm the kind of God that when I capture my enemy, I throw them a party and I transform them by grace so that they become friends. That's what I'm like. And this is the blindness. And this is the blindness of all of us. That Syria thought that God was their enemy, so we needed to destroy him. But God was the one who is actually for them. And is the one who wants to bring life. And we just naturally think that God is against us. I think even if you've been a Christian for as long as you can remember, there are many times that God's commands, they feel like they're against you. They feel like they're restricting your happiness. That if I'm really going to find life, I've got to fulfill my desires, I've got to do what I want, I've got to achieve my purposes, and God is getting in the way of that. You ever feel that way? I do. And that God's commands about sexuality, or God's commands about money, or God's commands about forgiveness, or telling the truth, or humbling yourself, we think that that is God fighting against us. God wanting to destroy us. But that's the blindness. We're not seeing correctly. He's a God who wants to liberate you. He's a God who loves to save. God is life, and even his commands are good. He's not taking away freedom. He's liberating you. He's for us, and he changes us by his loving grace. You can actually look this up. There's a guy named David Wilkerson who was a Pentecostal minister in the mid-1900s, and he was convinced that gang members were blind and needed to know the love of Jesus. And so he actually moved into the middle of Queens, New York, mid-1900s, where some of the gang violence was the highest there was. And he just started trying to get to know gang members and share the gospel. And they more and more were trying to get him out of town and were frustrated with him until finally the leader of the Mau Mau gang named Nicky Cruz actually confronted David one day in his neighborhood. And here's what he said. He pulls out a knife and he says, if you come here again, I will cut you into 1,000 pieces. And Nicky had killed a few people, okay? And David looked at him and said, if you cut me into 1,000 pieces, those 1,000 pieces will still love you. And here's the deal about Nicky. He had actually killed men before. He had never heard another man say that he actually loved him. And he ended up being converted. He became an evangelist. He's still a minister today. Because what opened Nicky's eyes was the person that he wanted to kill, the person he was considered, was convinced was his enemy, loved him, showed grace to him and forgave him. It's powerful. Grace is that powerful. It actually changes people. And the blinders are being removed in your life when you begin to realize that God is not, he's not mean or petty. We would know that. He is full of grace. He's about forgiveness and new beginnings. And so bring it all together, right? We're saying that blindness has been removed when you see that God is actually for you. He throws a feast for his enemies. That God is actually with you and that he actually cares. And the passage ends with the Syrian army who had set out to kill Elisha. The passage ends that when they follow Elisha, it leads to a place of forgiveness and feasting. Does that sound like anybody else you've heard of? Because when you fast forward 700 years chronologically, God himself is going to come to earth in the person of Jesus. And of course, Jesus is always going to see perfectly. He has no sin to distort him. And on the night before he's going to die, what's called Maundy Thursday, he's in a garden. And there's armies that surround him, ready to arrest him, Roman armies and religious leaders. And Peter, who is actually characterizing blindness, you know what he does when the army surrounds him? He takes out his sword and he whacks off the guy's ear and says, "Here we go, let's beat our enemies." And Jesus, Matthew records this, Jesus stops Peter, says, tells him to put his sword away. And you know what he says? He says, "Don't you know, Peter, there are 12 legions of angels surrounding us right now. I could call them all in right now and end it." It's the armies. It's the armies that surround Elisha. But he doesn't. And he goes to the cross and he dies. And if you want to know whether you see or whether you're blind, this is the central question. What do you do with the cross of Jesus Christ? Because blindness means that you look at the cross and here's all that you see. There's a poor, naked Jewish man who got sideways with the Roman government and religious leaders. And he died. And it's sad, but, you know, it happened to a lot of people. Because that's what it looks like if you just look by sight. But seeing by faith and seeing what is ultimately true is you realize, here's what the cross means. That what's going on at the cross is the wrath of God is being poured out on Jesus as he cries out, my God, why have you forsaken me? Because he is wearing what otherwise you would not see, which is my sin and your sin and all those who trust in him. You see, Jesus on the cross is being abandoned by God, by the surrounding presence of God, so that all of us who trust him can know that you're never left alone, can know that you will be defended. This is what Romans 5 makes explicit, that while we were enemies, Christ died for us. Jesus is taking the place of us on a cross so that we can get what he deserves, so that we can be made friends by faith alone. So when you look at the cross, this is what makes invisible visible. What we all struggle to believe is that God is actually for you, that he loves you, that God loves us so much he would rather die than not have us. This is the key. Look at Jesus. Christianity really does hinge on Jesus. He's the interpretation of everything. Christ crucified, risen, and risen is saying. It's what you interpret everything else through if you're a believer. Have you done that? And I'll just tease it out quickly, very quickly, with a couple things. If you're seeing correctly, I really think that means that we're called to pray more. Think about prayer. Prayer is so weird. You're like talking to this God that you cannot see, to this God that really you don't audibly hear. But when you pray, what are you doing? You're taking God at his word. That because of Jesus, God hears my prayers. He's given me access to the Father. And so to live by faith means we probably pray more and we talk less. That I'm usually convinced what's going to change a student is my perfect answer for their question, which never happens. But probably what's going to change that student is actually prayer. Leaning into the unseen. Second of all, I think like seeing the world as it really is means that if you're a Christian, we just can't get mad at blind people. Like that's... Unbelievers are characterized as blind. And there's just this sick disease that runs in all of us called pride and self-righteousness, and it just has got to die. Because it creates this us versus them posture, where people who don't see, instead of us having compassion, we respond with threats and fear, like those people are ruining culture or politics or our city or whatever. And that's just not seeing. Seeing is compassion. And asking God to open eyes, because he's opened mine, and moving towards them, which is the last thing. If you see correctly, it means that you've begun to love your enemies. You see, if I once was blind, but Jesus loved me as an enemy and made me see, that has to give us humility and respect with other people. People who assume that you're their enemy, because you don't believe what they believe. There should be people who think they're your enemy that are surprised by the way that you love them and serve them. And I'll just end with this. My friend Isaac Jenkins, who works with Crew, I'm on REF Sunday advertising Crew, okay? So whatever you think about that. He told me a story about last spring break when they went on their mission trip down to Cuba. And he actually ended up in a witch doctor's house. And he was sharing the gospel with this woman witch doctor. And he said the scene was so interesting because lined up outside the witch doctor's house were literally almost 100 people. And what they were trying to get into the witch doctor for was this. Most of them wanted the witch doctor to put curses on the people that they hated. Like, that's what witch doctors do. But here was Isaac telling the witch doctor about a God who doesn't put curses on the enemy, but forgives enemies. And it was such a contrasting picture. That's who our God is. Here's my invitation. Do you see? Do you see the God who is for you? The God who does not abandon you? The God who is full of grace? Because if you don't, you can ask Him. It's a gift of sight. That's an invitation. Let's pray. Father, I thank you for sending Jesus to help us see what otherwise we would never see, that you are a God who is full of grace. And I pray for the first time or for a thousandth time, we would see what is true, and you'd help us to live according to it, and you would help the blind to see this morning by the power of the Holy Spirit. In your Son's name I pray. Amen.